in what he viewed as an excessive use of force. Here is a description of the court. Quote, "As he was walking past the Boston Common on the evening of October 1, 2007, Simon Glick caught sight of three police officers, the individual defendants here, arresting a young man. Glick heard another bystander say something to the effect of, 'You're hurting him, stop!' Concerned that the officers were employing excessive force to effect the arrest, Glick stopped roughly 10 feet away and began recording video footage of the arrest on his cell phone. After placing the suspect in handcuffs, one of the officers turned to Glick and said, 'I think you've taken enough pictures.' Glick replied, 'I am recording this. I saw you punch him.' An officer then approached Glick and asked if Glick's cell phone recorded audio. When Glick affirmed that he was recording audio, the officer placed him in handcuffs, arresting him for, inter alia, unlawful audio recording, in violation of Massachusetts wiretap statute. Glick was taken to the South Boston Police Station. In the course of booking, the police confiscated Glick's cell phone and computer flash drive and held them as evidence." Unquote. He was charged with violating the wiretapping statute, disturbing the peace, and aiding in the escape of a prisoner. Well, the wiretapping statute is for covert recordings, if you do something like phone tapping. But I mean, we know the government does phone tapping and isn't held accountable. And if you're asked, "Are you recording this?" and you say yes, I mean, the guy was a lawyer and he announces in advance, "I am recording this," and yet this is apparently covert recording. So although we consider that it's impossible to define exactly what's going on with mathematical certainty, we've heard about the difficulty of codifying every act. Well, it turns out that's irrelevant anyway, because if a policeman says black is white, then black is white, unless a senior policeman says no, in this case white is white, in which case he's senior, so his verdict counts. So of course it just comes down to what people say, unless there's some evidence that other people, third parties, could look at and evaluate. That seems to me what this hinges on. Do citizens have a right to document their interactions with the system? Because if they don't, then you're not allowed to take photos. Whatever happens, happens. Oh dear, you got a busted lung or whatever it was, and it's your word against his, and he's a police officer, so his word counts for more than yours. The danger to the system of people documenting their interactions is manifestly people will say, "Well, this is a complete rip-off, isn't it? They say one thing and they do another. They do talk good talk. The law sounds like a good deal." Well, okay, the law certainly sounds like a better deal than it actually turns out to be. As followers of truth, I'm not interested in what is talked. I'm interested in what is walked. And what the internet and surveillance technology gives us is a chance to record that. Now, tell me why the system should be so afraid of people recording it. Unless the system knows, I'm personifying it here slightly, because these decisions are actually made by individuals. Yes, those individuals might be blinkered in obedience, they might be good people trying to get out, or they might be psychopaths who see the system for what it is, who say, "Well, I'm currently in a situation which I like, having power over these people, and I'm damned if I'm going to give it up to a few bunch of kids with some technology." Now, at the moment, the gloves are still on to the extent that they're bothering with any of these legal wrangles. I don't think they did a lot of legal wrangling in 1939 in Germany. But the US, it seems to me, is not very far away, and inaction, I suggest, highly unadvisable. Just for the record, if anybody's interested in working on a citizens surveillance project, or if they know anybody who is, I have the domain name openpolice.org that I might throw into the pot if I thought it was a good one. Now let's hear from Jonathan Turley. This is the recording that brought him to my attention. He's speaking about state secrets privilege which, like diplomatic immunity, is kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card if they can't be bothered with the legal wrangles. Ah, well, state secret, you know? Only it's not for individuals, this is for the government.
For those of you who are not familiar with the military and state secrets privilege, there's a good reason. And this is not to belittle its basis, but it's actually not stated in the Constitution or in any statute. That doesn't mean that it's necessarily invalid, but it is one of the most important doctrines and one of the most controversial that actually doesn't have footing in constitutional or statutory form at its creation. And with the exception of maybe the Ferris Doctrine, it is, I would say, probably the most controversial in that sense. It began, of course, with the United States versus Reynolds, which began with a crash of a plane that belonged to the Air Force, but was resulted in the deaths of three civilian contractors. When their family sued, the government refused to turn over critical information from the crash site. They said to a series of courts ending in the Supreme Court itself that that report contained very sensitive national security data and information, that indeed American lives and security would be put at risk if it was disclosed. The Supreme Court fashioned out of Reynolds what we know today as the state secrets privilege. And that privilege allows the government to seek dismissal not just of cases against it, but even cases against third parties, where the government can come into a case and say, you just can't litigate this issue because we have national security interests at stake. The result is often that counsel on the other side is not given access to the information. It's basically a bullet out of the dark. What's interesting about these cases is that often lawyers, including myself, have alleged that the government was lying. In Area 51, there was a very serious question about whether the government had misrepresented to the court the sensitivity of the information involved. Area 51 was somewhat unique because I had the information. Most times, counsel does not. With Reynolds, however, the great irony is that after all these years of challenging the privilege and saying that misrepresentations are often made, that report was finally made public. And all these decades later, it turned out that the report had nothing sensitive in it. Nobody has countered that view. The report was absolutely devoid of sensitive material. What it was full of was evidence of clear negligence on the part of the government. So Reynolds was a case that gave birth to this privilege on a foundation of misrepresentation. And indeed, in the Herring case out of the Third Circuit, the circuit found that and found that this was rather bold and raw in terms of a misrepresentation, but that they would not open up the case again, which, frankly, I can understand. I was hoping they would, but I don't think it was an outrageous decision. They felt that it's difficult to open up cases after that length of time. But for those of us practicing in this area, it was the ultimate irony of Reynolds, that the very thing that we complain about in these cases happened at the case that articulated the privilege. Now, in Area 51, we had a case where the government declared state secrets privilege over everything and refused to acknowledge even the existence of the base. You've seen the movies. And even though we could see the base from public lands, and so we had these rather bizarre hearings where I would tell Judge Pro, Judge, if you get into a car with me, I'll point the base out to you. Okay, I can show you the base. And they didn't do that, so I finally filed a case in D.C. and waited for the Justice Department to file a venue change, which I expected. And so as soon as they put in for a venue change, I said, okay, what's in Nevada? Why am I going to Nevada? And that took about 2 weeks in front of Judge Ritchie, who actually had fun with the issue and tortured the DOJ over it. And then finally, for 2 weeks later, he said, you know what, we've had enough fun. Just go to Nevada. There's something there. Eventually, they had to admit the existence of Area 51 when we said that when we purchased Russian satellite pictures of the base and French satellite pictures, and said we were going to call the military attaché to the Russian embassy, who would tell the American people what Area 51 was. And about one day later, they acknowledged existence of the base. But they still used the privilege. And what's fascinating about Area 51 is that the thing they invoked the privilege over was a report in our possession. And so I had the report. And they insisted it contained sensitive national security information, which it did not. And a lot like Reynolds, what they did not want to admit was that there was any hazardous waste at the site. Because if they admitted even cartridges from copy machines, it would mean that they were in clear, flagrant violation of federal law. And so this all boiled down to the privilege being invoked over things like paint and questions I gave them about confirming that they have pesticides at this base, or aircraft, which we have pictures of. So that's an example of how frustrating the privilege can be.
Well, respect to Jonathan Turley for pointing that out and speaking so clearly there. Less respect for him saying, oh, no need to open that again. I mean, if I heard him correctly, then individual people said, let us say that there is confidential information here and it'll save everybody a lot of bother. And their influence held sway at the Supreme Court that made, for the government, very convenient doctrine called state secrets privilege, which says if they say, oh, it's a state secret, too confidential, then all bets are off. Slightly like playing a game of poker with somebody who reserves the right, if he feels like it, to change his hand for anything he feels like. Not the kind of game you'd want to play regularly. So this is known that people said, yeah, let's pretend we have information, which wasn't secret at all. It was published. Not sure whether that was an accident or not. Or were they waiting till those people were dead and therefore not liable for treatment by the legal system? I mean, it seems to me that even in its own terms, the legal system is run by crooks and liars. Have I just said that the emperor has got no clothes? Well, are we looking to fix this from inside the legal system? I mean, he's a lawyer, and yes, he mounts legal cases, so obviously he does seem to be looking to do something like that. And the best of luck to the guy. It doesn't seem to me that playing a crooked game is going to change a crooked game. And for another example of how the powers that currently be play fast and loose with the law, this is the first half of a podcast by Sheila Dean. It's called Waking Up Orwell. And it's an interview on legislation associated with the US border wall. It's from March this year.
Welcome to a special podcast edition of BeatTheChip.org. I have on the line Scott Nickel with No Border Wall from Texas. So Scott has been working with No Border Wall Coalition, a coalition whose aim is to basically combat portions of the Real ID Act that are mandating the fence and the extension of the border wall fence to the exclusion of 36 federal laws. They're laws that were in place before the Real ID Act, but for whatever reason, the DHS feels that they are so inclined to overlook these laws and go ahead and build their fence. Apparently there's a new bill that's going to create this as law, sponsored by Representative Bishop out of Utah. So, Scott, tell me what's going on.
Well, basically, in the Real ID Act, the Homeland Security Secretary was given the power to waive any and all laws that he or she sees fit in order to build roads and walls along the southern border. In 2008, Secretary Chertoff used that power to waive 36 laws. There were environmental laws like the Clean Water Act and Endangered Species Act. There were laws like the American Indian Religious Freedom Act and the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. So all those laws were wiped off the books in order to build border walls that would have otherwise violated them. What's going on now is that just this week, Utah Representative Rob Bishop has introduced a bill that would take that waiver authority and put it into law. So it wouldn't just be the Homeland Security Secretary gets to decide to waive these laws. The laws that were waived for specific portions of the southern border where there are now border walls would be codified into law, basically. Those waivers would be extended. They would become indefinite. They would not just be for border walls, and they would not just be for the same sections of the southern border. Bishop's bill would extend that across the entire southern border from San Diego to South Padre Island in Texas, across the entire northern border from Maine to Washington, and across all of our maritime borders. And it would then, from those points, extend inland 100 miles. So anybody living within 100 miles of an ocean or a land border would now be subject to these waivers, which would mean that if Customs and Border Protection decides that some measure would help them to achieve operational control, and operational control gets defined as not a single person getting into the United States, anything that they want to do, those laws don't apply. There's nothing you can do about it. So you live in New York City, you live in Seattle, you live anywhere in Hawaii, you live in anywhere in Florida. It's not just, you know, along the U.S.-Canadian border or the U.S.-Mexico border. Live 100 miles from any of these land or maritime borders, these laws don't apply to you. You know, Safe Drinking Water Act doesn't matter anymore for as far as Border Patrol is concerned. Anything that has been named in that earlier waiver does not protect you anymore.
Wow. So what agency is really getting oversight here?
In some ways, it's going to the Department of Homeland Security. They're not asking for this. Honestly, there was a congressional hearing this morning, and they were not asking for this. Customs and Border Protection was not asking for this. This is Bishop's own deal. He's the one that came up with this grand scheme. It's basically just an expression of this tremendous overreach on the part of some of the more extreme members of Congress, you know, essentially saying, the laws we don't like, we will wipe away. You know, especially environmental laws, but certainly not restricted to environmental laws.
I don't know. There seems to be a lot of that going around in Washington right now. It seems to be almost like a flu.
It's easy. I mean, it's so much easier to do that than to actually comply. But it's astonishing to have politicians who campaign on this mantra of law and order just wiping laws off the books. You know,
Would it be wiping them off the books, or would it be waiving them? Because a waiver is just like, we're not going to observe those, and removing them from law, period, is different.
Well, it's basically saying, we're not going to observe them. You guys can still observe them, you know, other people, but when you exempt a law for any party, the law is not a law anymore. It's an option. And that's where you run into a fundamental problem. If you can wipe all these laws away for Border Patrol activities, you could do it for anything else. You know, you just talk to your local congressperson and get them to write you an exemption. If the waiver provision, you know, it had no hope of getting passed on its own merits, so they had to slide it into the Real ID Act, which it didn't really relate to, and then they had to slide the Real ID Act into these other must-pass bills that it didn't relate to.
I don't know, I have to make an expression here. I'm kind of shocked. You know, it comes at a time when Florida really struggling with their civil liberties all of the time, and they've kind of become like the example guinea pig state of what it's like to live in America with no civil liberties.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any thoughts on why Obama has become, in his maybe second into third year, worse or as bad as George Bush on these things?
My guess would be that, you know, he's seeing all of his decisions as being pragmatic, you know, along the lines of President Clinton. But I think, you know, he's got to take a stand on certain issues. And I think that, you know, when you talk about wiping the enforcement of laws completely away for a huge chunk of the United States. When you talk about protecting people's civil liberties, you know, he just needs to take a stand. And you know, political pragmatism may have its place, but there are some things where you just have to take a principled stand.
So tell me about what's going on with the border wall fence. What is your policy? How are you guys responding to this as a coalition?
Well, the bill just came out yesterday, so so far our response has been pretty limited. But no, I think, you know, we've been very strongly opposed to the waiver provisions from the beginning. You know, we felt that the Supreme Court should have taken up the pair of constitutional challenges that were raised to the waivers, to, you know, under the existing waivers for the Real ID Act. And, you know, we feel just as strongly that if the Bishop bill does pass, and I think in the current makeup of the U.S. House of Representatives, it has a pretty good chance, if you don't have anybody standing up for the rule of law and opposing this, if it does pass, it will be unconstitutional. There's just sort of no way around that fact, because you don't have equal justice, for one thing. You know, that means that I, who live 10 miles from the border, I can have Customs and Border Protection doing terrible things to my drinking water because they've been given the power to waive the Safe Drinking Water Act, whereas somebody in Kansas who is not within that 100-mile zone doesn't have that. You know, he doesn't have that risk. The law applies to them, but not to me. You know, there are a number of fundamental constitutional questions that are raised by this. And I think the Supreme Court should have taken this up. I think that, you know, the Real ID Act waivers are unconstitutional. And I think that, you know, and our coalition has been very outspoken in trying to get that message across.
So what is it like with Customs and Border Patrol now? This isn't a bill put together by them or even the DHS. Why do you think people like Representative Bishop is pushing the border into the lap of DHS?
I feel like it's probably just political grandstanding on his part. I don't think that, you know, honestly, he doesn't know anything about the border. He talks on and on about how, ooh, I visited once a year ago. That's not expertise at all.
Well, is there any other policy or possibly political reason why he would be pushing this specifically onto DHS?
I believe that Representative Bishop is basically just grandstanding. You know, I think that he's coming from a very virulent anti-environmental stance and a very virulent anti-immigrant stance. And in putting those two together, the reality of the border is irrelevant. You know, he's coming from basically pure ideology. In today's hearing that he chaired in the House of Representatives, he repeatedly showed images of, you know, bodies.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there. I'm just going to have to stop you there. And here's the reason why. Why is it when a conservative gets up and flashes photos of the border area or mentions the word 9/11 or Homeland Security, that suddenly is pragmatic? Whereas if we have laws and the Constitution and the rule of law, that's idealistic?
Well, I think that's the fundamental problem. Is, you know, the pictures that he's trying to show of these bodies weren't actually taken in the United States. He's showing bodies of people who were killed in Mexico and using that to argue that we have to waive laws 100 miles into the United States. It's not even saying, here's a problem that we have here at home. He's ignoring the fact that El Paso and San Diego are two of the top 10 safest cities in the United States. You know, he's basically fear-mongering. It's not even that it's pragmatic, it's that it's just false. It's just blatant falsehood and blatant misrepresentation of the reality that I live on the border every day. I mean, I live in a pretty quiet town, and I'm 10 miles from the border. You know, he lives in the middle of Utah, so who knows? Maybe he actually believes the stuff that he's saying, but whatever the case may be, the image that he's presenting and that he's using as a basis for his legislation is just false.
So, yeah, a law based on lies, which, of course, is a law, and therefore sacrosanct. I'd say, how about if a law is based on lies, then that law should be reversed. So if the state secrets privilege was introduced with deceptive intent, it shouldn't be kept on the books. Similarly, human rights of corporations. Other laws, if you check the small print, you'll find, that's called a legal precedent. And it may have been based on lies, but it's been set now and we followed it now, so now it counts. Yeah, I guess you've got to be a finely trained legal mind to appreciate the nuances of that, and I'm not a finely trained legal mind. Just seems an awful lot more likely to me that the people who changed that border law thought, how can we get some hydraulic fracking into Florida without the interference of the Clean Water Act? I know. Let's tie that to the border law thing that we had planned to go through. Except, of course, I think fracking's already immune from the Clean Water Act. But do you think they're really interested in protecting humanity in the US from unclean immigrants coming over the border? Are they perhaps more interested in what they could do to control the 99%-something of humanity that doesn't have such privileges? Or how they could keep the wheels of commerce turning, save themselves a few more legal dodges? It's not always the need to exempt laws. Sometimes they'll dust through the history books, find a law and think, hey, maybe we could use this. Witness the use in the G20 demonstration in Toronto of the vintage Public Works Protection Act, which was dusted off and given a second lease of life 6 decades after it was introduced. And not that they got as far as telling anybody what they were actually doing. This is a discussion on that note from December 2010, which was posted to radioforall.net.
This all took place yesterday, which would have been Tuesday, December the 7th, and it was a major report released. It was about a bit more than 100 pages, and it's got full of information. One new thing that the ombudsman mentioned that's going on with this report that hasn't been done in an ombudsman investigation before has been the social media aspect of it. And that even includes YouTube videos that they've gone through. They've gone through Facebook, Twitter. They've gone through a whole lot of evidence, I guess, through these blogs and, you know, the words and videos and pictures that people have posted. So that was an interesting one. And, you know, there was 2 people charged on the Public Works Protection Act, but you actually go through the massive what they got, and it was actually, there's so much trouble with just people being searched and stopped and searched, you know, never charged with anything. Only 2 people are ever charged in her, but thousands searched and whatnot. Well, why don't we just, I'll just play this one, and get Robin's interview guest up next, but here's the hard-hitting words from the Ontario Ombudsman, Andre Morin, on the G20. Word up.
The idea was that this new regulation would help the police close the gaps. Some people in the ministry were rightly concerned about the optics of using wartime legislation, but others saw the regulation as mere technicality. So the decision was made not to publicize it. Instead, they quietly handed the police extravagant, sweeping powers under 71-year-old law, powers that would almost certainly be illegal and unconstitutional under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Little did they realize that once this powerful weapon was unleashed, it would be almost impossible to control. Reviving this dormant piece of legislation, coupled with the adoption of the regulation, created a legal landscape where people were detained by the police and compelled to identify themselves, answer questions, and submit to warrantless searches, even if they simply wanted to walk away. Responsible protesters and civil rights groups who took the trouble to educate themselves about their rights prior to the G20 had no way of knowing they were literally walking into a trap. They were literally caught in the act. An act of public entrapment. The Public Works Protection Act and its pernicious regulatory offspring. Many of you will remember the added confusion when the Toronto Police Chief and some of his officers described the regulation as, quote, a 5-meter rule. Some of you reported about it. But there was no 5-meter rule. And even when this was corrected, police continued to arrest and search people well beyond the security zone. Our report is full of stories from people who encountered this treatment, as well as photos that capture the unforgettable scene of those 2 days. Our investigation revealed some very troubling facts about the ministry's conduct in sponsoring this regulation and failing to publicize it. It was unreasonable and grossly unfair. I'm convinced that the regulation was necessary and probably illegal. I've also raised serious questions about the Public Works Protection Act, a law that no other province has. This is why my main recommendation to the ministry is that it revise and consider replacing the Act, particularly in terms of the powers it confers on the police, and that it ensure that such regulations are always clearly communicated to the public in the future. I'm very pleased that the ministry has agreed to all my recommendations. And I look forward to seeing the results of the Honorable Roy McMurtry's review of the Act. Regulation 233, it's ground zero, was in Chief Blair's office. No other police agency wanted anything to do with this regulation. It was sold to the province, and the province implemented it. And many of the other law enforcement partners learned about the existence of this regulation and then the misspoken application of this regulation the very time you and I learned about it when it was reported in the media. The technical aspects of Regulation 233 was to close the loop on the fence, the infamous fence in downtown Toronto. But that, to me, was the smallest effect of that regulation. The most significant effect of Regulation 233 was that it revived a piece of wartime legislation that was passed in 1939 to protect infrastructure in Ontario from the enemies of war. And the elephant in the room at all times in the discussion of law enforcement surrounding this event is, was it really required to enact a wartime piece of legislation that gave phenomenal powers to the police and was of questionable legality? We did offer the chief two opportunities. I believe the letter's been distributed to you on August 5th. We wanted, first of all, the officers who were shown in various photos and video footage to come forward and explain what their understanding was of this regulation that was passed. And that was refused. The chief refused us access to those officers. And then, again, subsequently on August 26th, we asked the chief to interview him because we wanted to know what his understanding was of this regulation and what instructions he passed on to the force, the Toronto Police Service. And again, we refused cooperation. You know, our role here is not like the SIU. We're not here to lay criminal charges or to investigate the criminal actions of the police. We're here to get an explanation. An explanation because this is a matter of great interest. And when the chief described this as the 5-meter rule, that bewildered you. It bewildered me. If any, there was any description that was more appropriate than the 5-meter rule, however erroneous, was to call it the 5-kilometer rule. Because people were in Arlington Gardens, 2 kilometers away, having their knapsacks examined and searched by the police. We encountered a woman who was leaving the Queen's Quay Loblaws, and she was getting her groceries examined by the police, even though she was hundreds of meters from the fence. And this happened throughout Toronto, without any legal justification. You got to be clear, police can ask whatever questions they want. You can ask people, what is your name? Please identify yourself. But when we saw that 3 police officers stopping an individual on a bike and using the authority of the Public Works Act to force someone to identify themselves and be searched, that is illegal behavior. You can't do that. There's no legal basis for the police to do that. Unless, of course, they're relying on the Public Works Protection Act. There are common law authorities where the police can, if they have reasonable grounds to believe you committed an offense, to search you. There's common law authority to protect international dignitaries within reason. There's no common law authority that I'm aware of that entitles the police to exercise prophylactic scan detention. And that's what they were doing. There was a premeditated, conscious, planned decision not to announce the existence of the regulation. You know, the government, the ministry had its website. City of Toronto had a website. The Integrated Security Unit had websites. Had ads in the paper warning about street closures, things that were going to happen. Was there any, at one point, mention that the police had a right, according to a 1939 law, to arbitrarily detain citizens kilometers away from the fence, to search their belongings, to force them to identify themselves? No, at any time there was not. And that was a conscious, premeditated decision by the authorities. Apart from a coterie of senior officials in government and the Toronto Police Service, no one else was aware of the existence of this regulation or the fact that they would trigger what amounted to martial law in downtown Toronto.
How much cooperation did you get from Toronto Police Service?
Zero. I mean, a zero cooperation, which is rather astounding. I'm not conducting criminal investigation. I could have subpoenaed Chief Blair. The ability under my act to subpoena people and to force them to give testimony under oath. Now, fortunately, this case, it was not necessary to go down that route because we had access and full cooperation by the provincial ministry, who was able to provide us the letters and communication they had with Chief Blair. So Chief Blair's participation was not required in the end. Really, we were able to get the job done without him. It's unfortunate, though, that we weren't able to interview those officers that were captured on video and still images because we wanted to know who had briefed them about their authority. But again, we found the answers to that through the ministry in the passage of a regulation under the 1939 Act. As I said, it's a relic. It's a civil rights landmine from World War II that was never repealed. It exists today, and it designates as public works, public buildings, public parks, streets, and highways. So theoretically today, the police could, on any of those areas, start saying, I'm enforcing the 1939 Public Works Protection Act. They didn't need the fence to do that. But people know very well, anyone who has a high school grade law education knows very well that the police do not or cannot arbitrarily detain people in Canada to ask for their ID. So people just ignore the 1939 Act, except here when Chief Blair petitioned the government.
Was this some sort of attack on our democracy, or was this some kind of madness that overtook the people in a position of power in the face of this kind of international pressure?
We have the means as a society to bring proper law and order. Many observers will tell you, legal experts, that you didn't really require any additional authority, that the common law authority and existing law was sufficient. But suppose the government disagreed. It had the option. The option was to pass a proper piece of legislation that protects people, not rely on a 1939 piece of legislation protecting infrastructure. In the 1970s, when Prime Minister Trudeau invoked the War Measures Act, he presented it in Parliament. There was a debate. Rightly or wrongly, it passed, and it led to the arrest of just under 500 people with about 60 charges. Fast forward to 2010, we bring back to life a 1939 Act that leads to the arrest of over 1,000 people with 99 charges outstanding. To me, that's disturbing. And for the citizens of Toronto, the days up to and including the weekend of the G20 will live in infamy as a time period where martial law set in the city of Toronto, leading to the most massive compromise of civil liberties in Canadian history, and we can never let that happen again.
Thank you.
We had enough of this G20. We had enough of Dalton. We had enough of Harper. Time to get rid of him. What the hell is this country coming to? We let the select few act like we dumb fools. 1.3 bill to control the back talk, then justify the actions of spending because of black bloc. Nah, the people ain't feeling that here. HST, G20, secret laws all this year. I think it's time we let them know that their tactics ain't working. No more wool over the eyes of the class that are working. The media only showing what they want us to see. So we have to press for the truth where the knowledge is free. Grab your copies of Basics, opportunity for fight back. Papers of the people, it's our people that write that. This ain't 86, Fort Pickens, Geronimo. We need to expose the truth, 2010 to Guantanamo. Abuse of power situations and the torture plenty. So come together. And your huff G20. We hate to take the city back, they don't treat us as equal. Enough of this issue, all power to the people. They be the protesters singing no Canada, our home and native land, but they really no fan of us. They handle us in an attempt to dismantle us. No cops researching women, probably got it on camera. Secret laws passed by Dalton, villainous ways. They increase police presence, it's a military state. Public Works Protection Act is a joke. Empowers cops and rent the cops to harass our working folk. Our city's cowards.
Word up. Public Works Protection Act, a joke? Well, that's what 4D is talking about. That was just 4D there on the with the G20, Whose Streets Are Streets. And then also, you just heard before that, Andre Morin, the Ontario Ombudsman, speaking about the G20 caught in the act. And we're going to have some more responses. We're going to have some political responses, some protester responses from the words of the Ontario Ombudsman coming on later on in the show.
Enlightened sovereignty, then, the natural extension of enlightened self-interest.
This ain't Canada right now.
This is in Canada right now?
No.
Wow.
No.
Right.
You're in G20. Airwaves that we're just getting into, one of the most hard-hitting topics we've talked about, caught in the act. The G20 Toronto has been caught. We finally have a over 100-page document documenting the horror stories of the G20. Let me draw your attention to page 44 of Andre Morin, the Ombudsman of Ontario's report, released yesterday. The war ends, but martial law still lingers. When the war ended in 1945, the nation returned to a peaceful existence. The Public Works Protection Act lingered, a remnant of a world in conflict. So this Public Works Protection Act was from World War II, first enacted, and it still lingers. With the exception of some relatively minor amendments, including in 1990 when the fine levy was increased from $500, other than that, the act has remained largely intact. And then I flip over to page 52. We've got in the right before the securing the perimeter section, this is in the section known as Good Fences Make Good Neighbors. It's paragraph 121. We've got an internal OPP email communication dated March the 28th, 2010, relating to a G8 G20 Public Works Protection Act, but the OPP indicated they were not interested in exercising authority under this arcane legislation. Here is a bit of this email that the OPP superintendent wrote to his chief superintendent that day. He said he's familiar with the act, and it's a wartime piece of legislation that was revised and updated during the NDP era, but we have looked at it extensively in the context of public order. We have always believed we would save it for a critical time, as it would not likely stand up to a constitutional challenge the first time is used. Having said that, I do not believe we require its implementation for the G8. Understand, this is the OPP saying that they are against the Public Works Protection Act being for the G8. So what we have here with the Public Works Protection Act is the Toronto Police wanting this act for the city of Toronto, and they got the province to go along with it. even though the OPP weren't going along with it. And it was even more than that. You know, when you actually get into reading the reports, there is a longer list of the organizations that didn't want to go along with it. But I was thinking, you know, why don't we throw it to the Ontario NDP leader, her reaction to this GHG20 secret law, the speech by the Ontario Ombudsman, the top watchdog, caught in the act. What does the NDP leader, Andrea Howarth, think about this GHG20 secret law?
Ombudsman confirmed what the people of the City of Toronto already knew, that Don McGuinty passed a law that he knew or should have known was illegal and unconstitutional. The McGuinty government not only went out of their way to avoid the democratic process, a democratic debate, they deliberately kept the facts about their illegal and unconstitutional measures from the public. When Dalton McGuinty invoked the Public Works Protection Act, there was no debate. There was no public discussion. And the facts were hidden from the people the government is supposed to represent. We'll continue to demand that full public inquiry. But first and foremost, the first thing that needs to happen this afternoon is that the Premier has to apologize to the people of this city. What happened was wrong. The Premier needs to simply admit it and apologize. The lack of participation by the Chief of Police is disturbing, there's no doubt. In fact, there's real concern around the tail wagging the dog, asking for the government to pass a regulation that gives the police more powers, and then the government simply acquiescing to that request. So there's a number of problems in that chain of events, and many people need to be held accountable. It's my job to make sure that the Premier is held accountable and that the Minister in charge is held accountable, and that's certainly what we're going to continue to do.
You said that the tail wagged the dog. Do you mean that the provincial government kowtowed to the police?
That's certainly what this report indicates, that the request, I think what the Ombudsman said is that the request for the regulation can be traced directly back to the office of the Chief of Police of Toronto. Seems to me that that's exactly what happened, that the request was made and the government acquiesced. In a democracy, the government makes the laws, and law enforcement enforces those laws. It's a bit backwards, if you ask me. And the last time I checked, we were actually a democracy here in the province of Ontario, and the government could have played this a lot differently than they did. In fact, other law enforcement agencies, other members of the Integrated Securities Unit, didn't want to see this particular piece of legislation invoked. From my understanding of the reading of this report, they were not interested. They didn't think they needed any extra powers. Well, if the RCMP didn't think they needed any extra powers, and the OPP didn't think they needed any extra powers, and the military didn't think they needed any extra powers, why did the government of Ontario think that it was necessary?
Do you have any comments on the Ombudsman's recommendation number one on the idea of revising or replacing the Public Works Protection Act?
Well, the Ombudsman has indicated his pleasure that the government is actually going to implement the recommendations. We await the government's move on recommendation number one with relish. Thank
you. Word up, Word of Mouth Wednesday. So that was Andrea Horwath, the NDP leader. How about we go right into the next man that spoke, Ontario PC leader Tim Hudak. The governing party of Ontario, the Liberals, were nowhere to be seen after the Ombudsman made this report. They weren't in the room, but here is the leader of the PC, Tim Hudak. What's his thoughts here on a secret law G20?
It's to change government. Now Ontario PC leader Tim Hudak will speak to the findings of the Ombudsman report.
Well, thank you very much, Garfield, my critic for public safety, community safety and security. A public inquiry into this mess is not needed because we all know there is one person who can answer all of the public questions today and immediately, and one person who owes it to families to come clean once and for all, and that's Premier McGuinty himself. Today I'm calling on the Premier to reveal all of the facts and end the cover-up.
So
which
that,
of
this
his
is the words from the PC, the Ontario Progressive Conservative leader, Tim Hudak. He was in attendance, also in attendance to watch the Ombudsman report, was also PC party member Randy Hillier. I saw him there, and I know he was one of the people that wrote an editorial, strong editorial against this secret law and this, you know, the tyranny that reigned during the G20. So in terms of the progressive members of parliament were there, because Peter Cormos was also there in attendance from the NDP, who made a powerful speech about the G20. Here's a bit more words from Tim Hudak on this G20 secret law.
It is a dramatic failure of leadership and deceitful. We're talking about Dalton McGuinty's law. I mean, quite frankly, we're talking about Dalton McGuinty's secret law that the Premier, don't tell me otherwise, knew had gone through cabinet. And don't tell me otherwise, the Premier knew that the government of Ontario was conspiring to keep the facts buried from the general public. We actually had a Premier of the province of Ontario and a Minister of the Crown who brought forward an illegal and unconstitutional law.
Illegal, unconstitutional, a secret law, and it was not published. This is some strong words. How about after I saw this Ontario Ombudsman and this political responses, after I walked out of Queen's Park yesterday, I saw one single protester protesting this G20 secret law, the police. Jefferson Rebu, here is an interview right here with one protester still out there protesting this G20 illegal actions. Why?
Daniel Levy here. We're here at Queen's Park, and we're in the front of Queen's Park, and I just heard the Ombudsman's report, and I found there's at least one protester out here still looking for a public inquiry here. Do you mind introducing yourself?
My name is Jefferson Rebu. I'm a criminology major from the University of Ottawa.
So what did you think? Why are you out here? You're holding up a sign that says, I demand accountability for the G20 police abuses public inquiry. Why are you out here?
Well, I've been actually out in front of the police station quite a bit lately. Basically, my fight is not against the police officers. That's one thing that people need to understand. I'm actually with the police. That's why I've studied police studies for many years. I think that a large percentage of police officers are great cops. A small percentage here are being protected. And obviously, I'm not sure why, but I have my ideas. Because of that, our police force is being unfairly stigmatized, and they're all looking bad. So I think we need an inquiry. We've got to get to the bottom of who did what, and you can't sweep it under the rug. Bill Blair can't come out and say, everything's fine, nothing happened, we reviewed the tapes, and we're exonerating all police officers because we can't identify them. Well, they had no problem identifying the black blocks with their facial recognition software that they paid millions and millions of dollars for.
Now, there's a few more minutes, but let's stop there in order to give time for the following speech by Ron Paul. We've looked at the fictional notion of rights. We've looked at laws which can be suspended or introduced at the drop of a hat. Now, that is some kind of make-believe. And what is all too real is American military power, upon which at one point there were certain safeguards, which all now seem to be de facto vanished. And let's hear what Ron Paul has to say on American warmongering.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The last nail is being driven into the coffin of the American Republic. Yet Congress remains in total denial as our liberties are rapidly fading before our eyes. The process is propelled by unwarranted fear and ignorance as to the true meaning of liberty. It is driven by economic myths, fallacies, and irrational good intentions. The rule of law is constantly rejected, and authoritarian answers are offered as panaceas for all our problems. Runaway welfareism is used to benefit the rich at the expense of the middle class. Who would have ever thought that the current generation and Congress would stand idly by and watch such a rapid disintegration of the American Republic? Characteristic of this epic event is the casual acceptance by the people and the political leaders of the unitary presidency, which is equivalent to granting dictatorial powers to the president. Our presidents can now, on their own, order assassinations, including American citizens, operate secret military tribunals, engage in torture, enforce indefinite imprisonments without due process, order searches and seizures without proper warrants, gutting the Fourth Amendment, ignore the 60-day rule for reporting to the Congress the nature of any military operation as required by the War Power Resolution, continue the Patriot Act abuses without oversight, wage war at will, Treat all Americans as suspected terrorists at airports with TSA groping and nude x-raying. And the Federal Reserve accommodates by counterfeiting the funds needed and not paid for by taxation and borrowing, permitting runaway spending, endless debt, and special interest bailouts. And all of this is not enough. The abuses and usurpations of the war power are soon to be codified in the National Defense Authorization Act, now rapidly moving its way through Congress. Instead of repealing the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, as we should now that bin Laden is dead and gone, Congress is planning to massively increase the war power of the president. Though an opportunity presents itself to end the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, Congress, with bipartisan support, obsesses on how to expand the unconstitutional war power of the president he already holds. The current proposal would allow a president to pursue war anytime, any place, for any reason, without congressional approval. Many believe this would even permit military activity against American suspects here at home. The proposed authority does not reference the 9/11 attacks. It would be expanded to include the Taliban and associated forces, a dangerously vague and expansive definition of our potential enemies. There is no denial that the changes in Section 1034 totally eliminates the hard-fought-for restraint on presidential authority to go to war without congressional approval achieved at the Constitutional Convention. Congress's war authority has been severely undermined since World War II, beginning with the advent of the Korean War, which was fought solely under a UN resolution. Even today, we're waging war in Libya without even consulting with the Congress, similar to how we went to war in Bosnia in the 1990s under President Clinton. The three major reasons for our constitutional conventions were to guarantee free trade and travel among the states, make gold and silver legal tender, and abolish paper money, and strictly limit the executive branch's authority to pursue war without congressional approval. But today, Federal Reserve notes are legal tender. Gold and silver are illegal. The Interstate Commerce Clause is used to regulate all commerce at the expense of the free trade among the states. And now, the final nail is placed in the coffin of congressional responsibility for the war power, delivering this power completely to the president, a sharp and huge blow to the concept of our republic. In my view, it appears that the fate of the American republic is now sealed, unless these recent trends are quickly reversed. The saddest part of this tragedy is that all these horrible changes are being done in the name of patriotism and protecting freedom. They are justified by good intentions while believing the sacrifice of liberty is required for our safety. Nothing could be further from the truth. More sadly is the conviction that our enemies are driven to attack us for our freedoms and prosperity, and not because of our deeply flawed foreign policy that has generated justifiable grievances and has inspired the radical violence against us. Without this understanding, our endless, unnamed, and undeclared wars will continue, and our wonderful experiment with liberty will end. And I yield back the balance of my time.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving.